This is Monday, November 4th, 1991, interview with former Major League pitcher Denny Gailhouse. Denny, in looking back over the years, let's start in the beginning of your career. You're from living in Doylestown, Ohio presently, grew up in Marshallsville. How did you get into baseball? Major League Baseball. How were you found? How were you discovered? Give us the story of your beginning.
I was a baseball player in high school. In my senior year, I pitched every inning of every game. In fact, in the tournament time, I'd pitch on Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, and Saturday afternoon. But then in the summertime, I went with a semi-pro team of adults. There was no Legion ball at that time. And I played with them and struck out quite a few hitters of the opposition adults. And somebody wrote to Cleveland or called Cleveland and acquainted a fan that said they ought to come down and look at this kid. And eventually, a scout by the name of Bill Bradley, who was all-star third baseman with the Indians at one time, came down to see me, and in that first game, I didn't know he was there, but I hit the first hitter on the head, a 3-2 pitch, and it was wild, and the guy didn't see it, and I hit him on the head, and I got wild and lasted about four innings before they took me out. But he came back later and saw me pitch on a couple of other occasions before I was signed. Then my first year, I was handled a little bit unusually in that he signed me to a Johnstown, Pennsylvania contract, which was not part of the Cleveland system. And that wasn't, I found out later, that wasn't a kosher thing to do. But anyway, I went to Johnstown, and it was an eye-opening thing for me to go into a professional spring training camp. This was in April when the weather was halfway decent at that time.
Oh, what year was it?
1930.
Okay.
It was 1930. And I had been used to just fooling around as far as being in condition with the semi-pro, just playing the games and everything. And the first spring training day, they had us run around the park and then run around again. And I wondered, well, when are we going to start playing baseball? But that was my eye-opener to that. But that's the way it went. Now, my first starting in a game was against one of the top semi-pro teams in Pennsylvania at that time, so they said, the Altoona Penn Centrals, which was a pretty good team. I started against them, and the first three innings, I struck out eight of the nine. The eighth hitter popped a little foul ball that went about 10 feet high, right straight above the catcher, and that was my extent for that day, and I was feeling pretty good about that, striking out eight of the nine, the other little pop-up. And we, in the shower afterwards, the manager said, well, we're going to have to change you all around. So that kind of took the wind out of my sails. And
well, what do you mean by change you all around?
I was throwing just my arm. And he said, throwing the way you're throwing, you'll never, you won't last. You can't play in pro ball because you got to pitch and relieve and do all that in the minor leagues. In those days, we did a lot of pitching.
Mm-hmm.
They baby him now. But so they got out, we got out the next day, and they worked with me and just easily throwing until got my body in behind it, and realized the catcher said, well, you're throwing harder than you were the other day. And it didn't seem like it. I was throwing the jar, the jerking on my arm wasn't taking place.
Was it hard to adjust?
No, I learned it in a couple sessions. And I was, and then I threw that away the rest of my life. I never had any arm trouble.
Never had any arm
trouble? No. I had caught a cold in my elbow one time, but it didn't keep me from pitching. I just couldn't throw a curveball. And that was in AAA. That was when I was at Minneapolis in 1935. And there was a couple starts that I made this crazy bone leader in your elbow was swollen about twice its size.
Mm-hmm.
And that from then on, I never pitched without a shirt on.
Now, you played in the minor leagues basically through 1935, yeah. Really catching on for sure with the Indians in 1936.
Yeah, well, in Johnstown, the second year, I had a real good year, earned run-wise, 2.12, something like that. And the Indians bought me back. That's a paper deal.
Well, who were you the property of then with Johnstown?
I was supposed to be a Johnstown property, but, but I belonged to Cleveland. So they bought me back then. So then they sent me to Fort Wayne, optioned me to Fort Wayne. I went over there and played in 1932. Had a pretty good year, 14-6, 14-8. And they recalled me and sent me outright to New Orleans. Now, there was a farm team then, but they sent me outright. Now, Billy Evans, the general manager at the time, called me and said, "Now, we're sending you down there outright, but that don't mean you still belong to us." And sure enough, I went down there, and then by July, about July the 2nd, I had won one ball game, and then I started starting. I was called a B-er, you know, Class A and Class B. I was a B-er. And I started, and from then on, the rest of the season, through the playoffs and through the Dixie Series, which we won, I won 21 ball games, 20 more games. And they bought me again. Then they optioned me out there the next year, and we again won the Dixie Series. And then they recalled me, and I was in a ball game or so. And then in 35, they opted me over to Minneapolis because Billy Evans wanted me to play in the daytime rather than pitch at night. And Toledo was the Cleveland farm team at that time, and what was then Double A instead of, it's now Triple A. But I played at Minneapolis under Donnie Bush, and I had a pretty good year there, considering everything. I had about 14 or 15 games won and about 10 losses, something like that. Most of my losses were in that old Nicolette Park with that small right field. But then they recalled me, and I pitched a game in the fall and won. And then the next year, in 36, was when I started and was there for the rest of my career.
Did you start annually? You started quite a few ball games for the Indians.
Well, all through the time, that time, the pitching it was a lot different than it is now. Now they've got the starter, the long reliever, the mid reliever, the short reliever, and the closer, the setup man and the closer.
Mm-hmm.
But that time, the premium was on starting and completing ball games if good. So I was a starter, and then in between times, especially all through the minor leagues, I would start when I was in New Orleans, start a ball game, rest a day, I'd be in the bullpen the next day, late in the game, if needed, for a couple of innings. If I wasn't needed, I'd throw in the sidelines and the rest of the day, and then start again. It was every fourth day starting with a relief in between or batting practice.
And you never had a sore arm, so obviously it didn't affect you.
No. It was that way through New Orleans and all through up at Minneapolis. And actually, it was a start and relief situation in Cleveland too.
In your career, there's a couple of incidents I'd like to get into that are fun for the baseball historian. You were the first opening day pitcher of the 1944 World Series for the St. Louis Browns against
right.
the Cardinals. A ball game you won, but a series that the Browns lost in six.
Right.
To the fan like myself, that World Series had to be your shining moment. Your pitching record in the two games you hurled was absolutely outstanding, and you took on one of the top pitchers in baseball at that time in both ball games, Mort Cooper.
Right, right.
What are your reflections on that 44 World Series?
Well, we were great underdogs in the series, and of course the first game, as luck happened, we got two hits in that first game, and they came together. the second one being a home run. So that was our two runs. Gene Moore singled, and George McQuinn hit a home run. And that was the end of some of our hits. But and I was able to kind of hold him off. And finally, in the ninth inning, with a 2-0 lead, Marty Marion got a double to lead it off. And we didn't pay too much attention to him because he wasn't going to hurt us. He could score and not hurt us, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
But it was to get the rest of the guys out, which I got a ground ball on the next hitter. He went to third. Then there was a fly ball, and he scored on the, after the catch for the run. But then we had two outs. And the next guy hit a fly ball to center field, and the game was over. So and that was the first game. And then the fifth game, when I was in that, that's a game we set a record for strikeouts that still stands. Now, that's...
You and Cooper both.
Yeah. The combined two pitchers in a nine-inning game.
Mm-hmm.
We threw a... Struck out 22. He had 12, I had 10, and that has never been broken. Now, there's been 25 strikeouts in the game, Koufax and about four Yankee pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And Koufax, I believe, struck out 15, the four Yankee pitchers struck out 10. But for a single nine-inning game, two pitchers, that's 22 strikeouts. I don't think, with the way they use pitchers now, I don't think it ever will be broken.
Now, you'd have to have a ball game like you pitched 2-0, and scoring came late on two home runs by, I think it was Danny Littweiler.
And Sanders.
And Ray Sanders, Ray the first
Sanders.
Baseman.
Uh-huh.
The Browns actually played a good enough ball to win that World Series, except for the defense.
Errors, a lot of errors, yeah.
You had, I think, given up 16 total runs, and of those, seven were unearned.
Yeah.
Which would have meant potential turnaround and given the Browns their one-shot world championship.
Yeah.
Were the Brown players disappointed at that, as you recall?
Well, any time you lose something like that, you're disappointed, but I think they were proud of the fact that they had won the pennant, I guess. I know most of us were, but it was an unusual thing for them. A situation they'd never been in before, of course. So I don't know. I just they were happy, but they look back at all the errors, and then there was one time in the second game I pitched. We had the bases loaded and one out, and two hitters took called third strikes. Now that's you don't do that with base with. The bases loaded, take called strikes.
Yeah, you should be up there swinging at something.
Anything that close
yeah,
to
you gotta
called,
be aggressive.
You had to be swung at.
Yeah, you got to be aggressive.
Yeah.
You had a strange year from my standpoint in that 1944 was a war year.
Yeah.
You were known for a good part of that season as a weekend pitcher.
Yeah,
and
I worked,
worked over here in
Goodyear Aircraft, and would get on a train on Saturday after work. And go wherever the Browns were going to be, and get there on Sunday, pitch on Sunday, and get on the train that night, come back to Akron, be back at work on Monday. But for early part of the season, when nobody was in tip-top shape because they didn't go south for training, they were all in the northern places. Well, I pitched pretty good, but I never got any runs to win. And finally, the conditioning of the other players got ahead of me, and there wasn't much of a chance of me doing a whole lot. So what happened then was they were going along and going pretty good. I saw a chance for the possibility of getting in a World Series with the Browns because they were leading by quite a bit at the one time. So I got in contact with my draft board, and I said, if I quit my job here, how soon would I be picked up to go into the service?
Mm-hmm.
And they said it wouldn't be before sometime in February or along about in there, not before that. So I said, well, I think I'm going to do that then.
So, get yourself back into full-time
so collection. So we got that, and then that year I won just 90 games and lost 10. But I was pitching pretty good at the end of the season.
Do you have contact with many of the players from that 44 Browns team?
No, not a whole lot.
Over the years, have you?
No, I see some once in a while. Well, I see Floyd Baker quite a bit. He lives in Youngstown. But other than that, we had a reunion 20 years later, and I saw some of the guys. A few of the fellows were there. But since then, I haven't seen, golly, hardly any of them.
Was that a good ball team? Now, I'm saying that only because I'm curious to the extent that it was a war team. And it appears on paper to be a pretty good baseball team.
They could have been a pretty good team. They could have
even
been
in a non-war year.
Yeah, they could have been a good team, but there was too many guys like Jakuki that pleasure took precedence over staying in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And like every book that you ever read about him, he had his, yeah, he was pretty heavy on the sauce. And in fact, the final game of this pennant season against New York, we had to beg him to take care of himself that night, and we'd give him a little snort in the morning before the ball game.
Yeah, that's tough sometimes for a fan who never played Major League Baseball to rationalize, because we would have all loved that opportunity.
Yeah.
And wouldn't have frittered it away.
It's really hard to comprehend that.
Yeah, it really is. But anyway, that ball club at least provided baseball historians with one bright moment in the history of the Browns, although a lot of people say the 1922 Browns was really a great baseball team.
Yeah, I guess they were, you know. They had some great players. Well, we had some guys that were good, like McQuinn and Stevens, and then there was Ketchard and Krivich in center field. We had some...
Chet Lobbs was on that ball club, too.
Yeah.
He was like you, was he not a weekender?
No.
For a while, wasn't he?
I don't think he was. No, I don't believe he was.
Okay. I just had been under the impression that perhaps he had played that way in 1944.
I think that everybody had played in gone into wartime jobs during the winter, but I don't think, he could have, but I don't recall
it
as that.
45, though, you went to Great Lakes Naval.
Right.
And you had a hell of a baseball team there.
We had a good team there, yeah. In fact, Walker Cooper, the Cardinal catcher, was on that team.
Who else was on that team, can you remember? Well, who did you play?
Bob Feller was there. There's just a semi-pro at first base. Max Marshall was a Cincinnati Red guy, just so-so major leaguer, I guess. He was there. Johnny Groth was a free agent, just a kid. He was on the team. He later played with the Tigers, signed and played with them. Pinky Higgins was there.
Now, who did you play? Just other naval?
Other service teams.
Other service teams, mostly. I guess I know you were some form of entertainment in those days to other to military personnel.
Right, right.
But some of the ball clubs they put together were absolutely outstanding baseball teams.
Right. Earlier, there were more out-and-out major leaguers on those teams. But then this is a winding down of the war years, and all the major leaguers that were really young enough to be in there were gone. And of course, I had four dependents at that time, and there was a 10-day period when they could draft 34-year-old players with four dependents, and I was taken during that 10-day period. So I spent that, it's funny, if it had been 6 months, but the other half of the year, I wouldn't have missed a season, but I went in April and came out in October.
You came out to play then with Boston Red Sox, 47, half of that season?
Well, I was with the Browns in 46 and the part of 47, and then I went back to the Red Sox about late June of 47. And I won 11 games for him in that little over half a year, so I had a pretty fair year for him. But that was one thing Cronin said to me. He was managing when I was there before and managing when I was there that time. And he said that I wasn't a very good pitcher's manager when you were here before, but you see, it's a little different now.
And this is in your second visit to Boston.
That's when he said, and I
said... What kind of fellow was he? He seems to be...
He was good enough. He's a good guy. I'm talking
about Jim McCarthy.
Yeah. And...
He had compiled a tremendous record of achievement with the Yankees.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, it all boils down to fact. When you've got players that can follow orders, you can win.
Mm-hmm.
A good manager that has good players is going to win, and a good manager with bad players is going to have trouble. And a bad manager with good players is going to have trouble.
So. 1948 is famous for the one-game playoff to determine the American League champion, Cleveland, and the Red Sox. You were selected by McCarthy to be the pitcher for the Red Sox in that one-game playoff against Gene Bearden in Cleveland. There's been a lot of conversation amongst baseball fans as to that choice. What are your recollections? How did McCarthy tell you you were going to be the playoff pitcher?
He sent Bertie Tebbets around to ask different players how they felt about starting the ball game the next day. And I don't know what the other one said, but I said, if he wants me to pitch, that's what I'm here for. And that's the end of it. And Bertie said, well, I think maybe you'll probably be it. Now, I didn't, and here's a little sidelight that I didn't know until probably 30 years later when I saw Bertie. He said, you know, after I told you that night, I went back into the McCarthy's office and told him what the different players had said and what I had said, and he said McCarthy turned a slip of paper over on his desk. It had my name on it.
So he had already...
He anticipated the other answers, I guess.
Apparently you wanted the ball.
Well, that's why I was there for it, the pitch.
Writers over the years have wondered, I guess, about that ball game. Did that affect you losing the ball game? Did that create a situation in your own mind where maybe people came down too hard on you?
I didn't know it, and I didn't. I think it affected the fact that I stayed there no longer. That I just went around in '49 and was there just a short while, and until I was given my release. Or was waived out of the league, and could have caught on with the White Sox, but I had a job with the Red Sox as a scout, so I thought I'd better stay with that, because that's a lifetime thing. It turned out pretty good.
You're still a scout.
Working at it now since I'm soon be 80 years old, so I'm still working.
You've been a scout all this time?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that set up the rest of your life.
Yeah.
In that ballgame, let's go back to the ballgame. There's been talk, too, that Gene Bearden was a surprise choice. Was he?
We felt he was going to pitch. We didn't think there was any doubt about it. The thing about it was that in our half of the first inning, see, Lou Boudreau hit a home run in the first inning off me after two were out. And it was a matter of the wind was blowing out that day. I don't know whether that is down in the history books or not, blowing out pretty strong to left field.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit a ball that Ted Williams actually started in on toward shortstop to catch it. And then he drifted back like he was going to catch it in front of the fence, and he went to turn like it was going to bounce off the fence and catch it, and it hit right on top of the wall and bounced into the net for a home run. But then in our half of the inning, we got a run in and had two men on with Bearden pitching, and Dorr hit a line drive to left center that in those days a lot of the gloves had big nets on them, the bottom, and Dale Mitchell, who wasn't the greatest fielder in the world, but adequate, he went across and caught that ball in the net of the thing. Otherwise, we'd have had two more runs, been leading 3-1. He did catch it, and that's it. Then the fourth inning, why, they got a couple of hits, and I outguessed myself. And that Keltner was up there, And I thought, well, he's going to lean out over that bag and try to pull that ball with his own arm. I'm going to bust one up in on him, brush him back. And I got it in. The ball was inside and probably shoulder high. I wouldn't throw at his head, but just up and in. And he backed off and hit it.
Fastball?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was interested in your pitch selection. Now, you had warmed up considerably the day before in reflecting. And then, you know, we're talking a long time ago, not 43 years ago. But was your arm weakened by all the warming up you had done the day before against the Yankees?
I don't know whether it was or not, but I thought I had good stuff that day. And, in fact, the umpire, Bill McGowan, said I had good stuff. He was behind the plate at that time, that particular game. But I did. I threw, see, the previous day was one of those games where our pitchers were in trouble. They'd get in trouble and then get out of it, get in and out, in and out. And it got to the sixth inning. At the bottom of the sixth inning, McCarthy, the manager, told me to go on down the bullpen and start, get up and loosen up and stay loose the rest of the ball game, even when we were hitting. So I did for what amounted to six half innings of throwing. That's on Sunday, and then the next day is when the game was. Now, whether that took something off my fastball or off my pitches, I don't know. But I felt all right, and I thought I had good stuff, and McGowan said I had good stuff.
That's a little bit of history that sometimes people don't realize. All the pitching you did the previous day in the bullpen.
Uh-huh.
But as long as you were happy that your stuff was strong the next day.
I felt it was.
Uh-huh. The scouting job you took after that with the Red Sox beginning in 19, was it 49 or 50?
Well, it was, I was doing a little of it for free while I was playing in 1950. 1951 is when I first started full-time scouting in this area.
1951?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about scouting, because today you look at a game that is certainly a lot different than it was back in the 30s when you started. What are the biggest differences you see?
Well, the equipment is so much different, so much better, and of course metal bats make it a little different. I don't know how I would have been able to pitch against a metal bat, because I used to break a lot of bats when I was pitching.
The throwing tight.
Yeah. And now with the metal bats in the amateur ball, well, a lot of those are base hits. They're dunkers over the infield, but that would have been little outs. So I don't know, but the equipment is better. They're using lighter bats. Everybody's swinging for home runs. I might have struck out more than I did as it was. Because everybody's swinging for the, like they always said, the home run hitters drive Cadillacs and the singles hitters are Fords or Chevys.
The equipment's better. Are the kids better today, or are they not as good as that?
I think they're getting stronger and everything, but I do think also that they are, that stretching business that they do and work is, I've never heard of so many hamstring pulls as they have recently. We didn't used to have those. Or if the guy did, he kept it quiet and kept playing because for fear of losing his job.
Well, that's a good point. Are there more injuries today than you recall when you were playing?
There are either more injuries or the players are more aware of the injuries and won't play when they have. I don't know whether there are more injuries or not now, but I think that there are, and there are more hamstring pulls, I'm sure. Because we did, what our conditioning was running. If we did what we had to do in the ball game. Now they do the stretching and the stuff and sit around and don't do enough of the running.
Well, they even do a lot of weightlifting, or at least controlled weightlifting, to build certain muscular strengths. Didn't do that in your day, did you?
No. That was a forbidden thing. That was swimming. You weren't supposed to swim.
What about golf? You weren't allowed to play golf, were you?
Oh, yeah. Well, golf was near enough to a baseball swing, I guess, that you weren't supposed to during the baseball season because it takes some of your strength. But in the off season, there was no problem there. school.
Who were some of your favorite ball players back in your days? When you were a major leaguer, yeah. What ball players did you enjoy watching play? What pitchers?
When they're enemies, you think, I don't want to see that son of a gun. But I like to watch Gomez and Ruffing, those guys. Ted Lyons, the White Sox.
Did you learn anything from them? Did they communicate bits of advice to other ball players? Ball players as close then as they seem to be today?
I don't know. My own philosophy was they're the enemy. The opposition's the enemy. The heck with them. Stay away from them. So don't want to get too friendly with them, kid.